This is the Skate Podcast on WEEI.com.
Bobby Orr, behind the net to Sanderson, Orr! Bobby Orr! Orr!
For the first time in 39 years, the Boston Bruins have won the Stanley Cup.
Talking Bruins and NHL.
Sure, old-time hockey. Like it is sure. Yeah.
With writer and producer Brian DeFelice.
Brian DeFelice is an emerging talent.
Bridget Prue.
Yeah. He's a little bit on the hot seat.
Burn him!
And WEEI.com Bruins writer Scott McLaughlin.
Great Scott!
Lace him up for some Bees talk right now.
I'm gonna get a dog!
It's the Skate Pod on WEEI.
Welcome into episode 175 of the Skate Podcast. I'm Brian DeFelice, joined by Bridget Prue and Scott McLaughlin. And pretty much take everything we talked about last episode and throw it out the window because they pretty much debunked all of our criticisms about the Bergeron line not scoring, about the power play not scoring, and just about their lack of energy in general. They've won three straight. They defeated the Wild 5-2 on Saturday. They blew the Sabres out of the water 7-0 the following day. So Bridget and Scott, a lot to like from this weekend's slate of games for the Bruins.
Yeah, for sure. They are fully back on track. It's like that team meeting they had Thursday morning after, you know, losing 3-4, losing to the lowly Blackhawks. It's like they just decided, okay, we're done with this. Like we're going to go back to dominating now. And they have, you know, took the game against Winnipeg, you know, maybe not a totally dominant game. You know, final score is 3-0, but Winnipeg had some chances. Swayman had to be really good. You know, there were still some things that were a little off, which I think we covered, you know, whether it was the top line or the power play or, you know, breakouts were a little rough. But then you get to the weekend and it's like they're backfiring on all cylinders. You know, Minnesota Wild were red hot. They were on a 14 game point streak going into that and they beat them. Top line steps up, has a dominant game. Sunday in Buffalo, everyone steps up, like just a total team effort. And they do it, you know, Sunday in Buffalo, like that could have been the game where you would have actually like understood if they just had an off day and didn't really show up, because it would have been like, okay, well, they already pulled themselves out of that skid beating Winnipeg and Minnesota. It's second day of a back-to-back, this travel, it's the end of a road trip. Krejci's out. Montgomery says soreness. I think it's probably as much rest as anything. I don't think he's that banged up. Dmitry Orlov gets a rest day. So you're like, everything's in place to, you know, just kind of cruise and not have a great game. And yet clearly they were determined to finish the road trip strong. Multiple players talked about, you know, the difference between a 3-2 road trip is a good road trip. 2-3 is a bad road trip. So they did seem to put some emphasis on coming out of this 5-game road trip with a winning record. And they just took it to the Sabres literally right from the start. Bergeron scoring 15 seconds in, and the Sabres were the ones who looked disinterested, who looked like they were playing a back-to-back with travel, which they weren't. They were rested. They played Friday, but had Saturday off. Should have been a desperate team. You know, they're not totally out of the playoff picture yet, although they keep slipping further and further back.
Yeah. They've lost what they've only won two of their last 11 games, I think. So
yeah,
they've had a few ties in there, but they, you know, you're not taking a lot of points if you're only won two of your last 11.
Yeah, it looks like their season's probably over. Like they look like they might, you know, be ready to potentially make the playoffs this year, and they're not. They're at least a year away. So good on the Bruins, though, to, you know, yeah, they caught the Sabres on a terrible day, which the Sabres also had a terrible day the last time these two teams played. That was a 7-1 game. But yeah, Bruins just brought it and closed strong, and they come back home feeling good about themselves when just less than a week ago, they were not feeling good at all.
Yeah. And I did think it was interesting when, like, we played the clip on Sunday Skate yesterday, with Razor, but when Montgomery was saying that the reason why the team thinks there was a lapse was because they clinched and it coincided with them clinching first place. And also like
clinching a playoff spot.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Clinching a playoff spot. They are still in first place, but they had never done it so early. So they're not like, they weren't used to having all of this time left in the season to not worry about making the playoffs. And that, you know, there, it's not a coincidence that that clinching and the fall off happened at the same time. But clearly they seem to bounce back in and handle everything differently this weekend. That Bergeron goal 15 seconds in, I think I heard Dale say this after the game. I'm not sure if it's true or what, but that's the fastest game winning goal in NHL history because nobody scored after it. So I know people have scored quicker than 15 seconds in, but I don't think any of those were game winners. So potentially was the fastest goal. I don't know where Dale found that stat, but
it sounded like he was kind of just guessing or like taking an educated guess at it. But yeah, I don't know if anyone actually found that to confirm it.
I have no idea.
I tried just a quick Google and nothing popped up immediately. So I was like, well, that's all I have time to do. So that was, you know, I put a lot of homework into that one.
Anyway, it was one of the fastest, if not. And that was really the beginning of the end. And by the, you know, was it 3-0 after 11 minutes? And it was just, it was ugly from that point on. It was like, it's over. They had a shot of like Jeff Skinner on the bench just looking sad. And I was like, oh, they just don't want to be here anymore is what it seemed like. But good for Swayman. 7-0 shutout was, they were just having so much fun after the game. He was doing his press conference and Allmark put a chicken wing in his mouth while he was about to start talking. And then I saw another video the Bruins put up where Brendan Carlo came and was trying to annoy him with a pizza also during the interview. So they were just having a good time again. And that's what they've been doing all season, but except for, you know, stretch of four games that we talked about not being their best.
I just have to say, if the Bruins are going to make a habit of bringing food to post game media scrums, they better bring enough for us.
I can just see Scott like putting his mouth open for a chicken wing. Like, I'm imagining it.
So I think the Bergeron goal is a good place to start, though, because for me, that's the biggest takeaway of this weekend's games, is picking up what we left off on last episode, which was the lack of production from that Bergeron line over the last, you know, 10 games or so. I had mentioned, I think over their last 16 combined games or 18 combined games, Bergeron, Marchand, and DeBrusk combined for like 7 points over that span. Well, in their last, they've combined now for 15 points in their last 6 combined games. Obviously, the last 2 games, all 3 of those guys have 5 points in the last 2 games. And they just look great doing it. Like, DeBrusk was using his speed. Marchand was tenacious in the forecheck. Bergeron was cerebral in the slot and getting open and just very opportunistic. And those 3 were playing how they play when they're on top of their games. And they did so against 2 teams that you guys mentioned. Minnesota certainly has been feeling it, but they're both playing for, like, you know, desperate hockey. They should be, at least those 2 opponents. And for me, that's the biggest takeaway. The power play was great too. To get some power play goals in the back of that was huge for this team's confidence. But the emergence for that top line again, which we all knew was inevitable, but again, it's about playing with confidence heading into the playoffs. And for me, it's better to see it sooner than later. And we were able to see it this weekend.
Yeah, on the power play, so now Pastrnak, power play goal in back-to-back games. He'd gone 21 games without a power play goal before Saturday, which is just crazy. I mean, that's a quarter of the season, and you just don't expect to see that from Pastrnak. But it's not just a Pastrnak thing. Like, it speaks to, you know, how much the whole top unit was struggling. Like, they just weren't – other guys weren't scoring. Things weren't opening up. Passes to Pastrnak weren't there. His shot wasn't there. I do think Hampus Lindholm has helped open that unit up a little bit. He just seems to, you know, it's nothing fancy. It's not anything super different than what McAvoy or Orlov does, but just seems to be a little smoother. And I think the way that he can walk the blue line seems to help. You know, I think other guys have stepped up as well. They've been able to get the puck into Bergeron in the bumper more. And you see that, you know, lead to Pastrnak's goal on Sunday, where he has just kind of that little tap pass over. So they're just getting more looks, and it just looks much more fluid. So, you know, we'll see if they can build off that and continue. But I do think the move of putting Lindholm up top in that top unit seems to help. It seems like he's a little bit better at running that unit right now than McAvoy was, or than Orlov was in his short time there.
Yeah. And he scored not on the power play, but he did score in the game against Buffalo as well. So did McAvoy. You are getting scoring from all over. You mentioned the power play goal by Pastrnak, but Hathaway scored for a second. Bertuzzi scored, but they took it back because he kicked it. He keeps coming real close, but no cigar for him quite yet. But yeah, they got the scoring from not just the top line, like you mentioned, but Coyle, and then over the past few games, Frederick has contributed quite a bit. So you're seeing a full team effort. Maybe their most complete effort of the season. It just looks like so easy for them, what they were trying to do. They're getting it done. And Coyle has looked that the third line in general, which I guess we should probably mention, lines were jumbled up because with Krejci out, everything was a little bit different. So Zacha was centering the second line with Bertuzzi and Pastrnak. I don't want to get you guys' thoughts on that. And then Greer was up on the third line with Coyle and Frederick, which was, you know, another guy in Greer that you throw up there, and he's another tough guy on that line. I wouldn't want to go up against Frederick coming on this side and Greer coming on the other side, because those are two guys that are kind of tough guys. But anyway, what do you guys think of all three of the bottom three lines were a little bit different because Lauko was back in and Zaborola played, so we hadn't had a chance to see him in a while.
Yeah, Scott, did is my memory fading, or did AJ Greer play a good portion of the first part of the season with Frederick and Coyle, or was that never? That was a combination, right? For
yeah.
a while,
yeah he did. Yeah, they were together. Yeah, they were together early on, and they were a good line.
Yeah, and then I think kind of Foligno kind of just really kept improving, and I think that just kind of naturally ended up switching a little bit. And then obviously Taylor Hall had time with them too. So again, that Coyle and Frederick combination has been pretty solid all year.
It was during the stretch when Marchand was out, so you know everyone had kind of been bumped up a spot. So Greer got some third line time during that time, and then when Marchand came back, everyone bumped down, and you know Greer was basically fourth line from there on out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that Coyle and Frederick combination has been pretty good for them all year, pretty solid. You know, there's been stretches where the offensive production has dropped off, and we mentioned it, like, last week when we recorded. And then since then, like, I think Frederick has three goals, maybe four in the last five or six games. Coyle has a couple of goals and some helpers. And you can just tell they're starting to play with that swagger and confidence again down low and beneath the dots. And that's where they're successful. Bridget, the Zacha, Bertuzzi, Pastrnak combination is – interesting to me, because that could be a potential line of the future, don't you think, Scott?
It could. I think they're gonna have trouble re-signing Bertuzzi as much as they'd like to. But yeah, I mean, certainly Zacha and Pastrnak, you'd have to figure are, you know, potentially linked together for a while. Yeah, the third line especially was great, whether it was, you know, a couple games ago when Bertuzzi was on it, or even Sunday with Greer. I think Coyle has been dominant really for a little while now, but especially these last few games. He has 9 points in his last nine games now, and he's shooting the puck. I think he has 15 shots over the last three or four games, something like that. You know, which comes right after a stretch where I think that Edmonton game was especially brutal, where they like, passed out of multiple grade A looks, and I'm assuming there was some sort of meeting or just a talk and like a reminder of like, hey, like excuse me, like I know you're a pass first guy, I know you always want to look to pass, but you got to shoot when it's there, and he has been recently. And we've seen Tyler Bertuzzi shoot more, which wasn't, you know, I think he was being a little too deferential when he first joined the Bruins. Always looking to set guys up, which we've seen how good he can be at that. He makes a lot of passes right on sticks in dangerous areas. So you do want him doing that as well, but he's had chances to shoot and hadn't. And now, you know, I think he has 9 shots over his last 3 games. So just a more of a shot first attack mentality in general from those two. Frederick, 3 goals in the last 3 games. Like, yeah, it's looked really good. And Coyle, again, it all starts with him and his puck protection. Anyone watching on YouTube, we're being joined by Melvin right now.
Yeah, he decided to pop his head into the camera. He was, I mean, I was keeping him off camera, but he decided he wanted to come say hi. I think he's trying to tell me he wants to leave. But anyway, sorry, Scott, he distracted you.
No, I was done anyways, but you can't keep a face like that off camera.
Bridget, no. Bridget, you mentioned Zboril as well, and we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the fourth line, right? I mean, Garnet Hathaway scores another nice goal for the Bruins. Just really a welcome addition for the team. And that stems from a good outlet pass from Zboril, who, you know, displayed patience. It was a bit fortunate the way it kind of ended up on Hathaway's stick. I don't know if it ended up being an indirect pass off the boards or if it hit a skate or if Hathaway kind of directed it off the boards to himself. But in any event, he ends up breaking free down the right wing and snaps a shot home. But it's a good idea by Zboril to have that patience and to just put the puck into an area where Hathaway can kind of retrieve it and not turn the puck over. And so that's an example of two people you mentioned, Bridget, the fourth line and Zboril kind of making an impact on that game and on the score sheet. How did you feel Zboril looked, Bridget?
So, I mean, he did better than I expected, I guess, is what I would say, because after being out for so long and also the chemistry, like not having time during the season to build up chemistry on any of the pairs, I was worried he was going to be in a place where he might have some frustration and it was going to be a pretty big learning curve to get back into it because he'd been, you know, not playing consistently for so long. So I think he played better than I was expecting. He did have a pretty good transition game, I thought. Helped break the puck out. That was one of the times, Brian, on the Hathaway goal, but I thought he looked pretty good. I thought he, you know, didn't do anything that you're like, okay, that's exactly why, like, we don't have him in the game. Like, there were no egregious mistakes or anything like that where you go, oh, you know, well, he's back out. Like, I guess we can't rest Orlov, or I guess we can't, like, get rest for our other guys if they need it, or, you know, they wanted, and the main thing is they wanted to see what they have for the playoffs. So if he needs to come in, if another defenseman does go down, they know that they have a reliable guy there. So I thought he did pretty well. I thought he, you know, played to some of his strengths.
Yeah, and he will play more down the stretch, especially with Forbert probably missing a little bit of time. He's already missed the last 2 games. You know, no real update yet. I'm assuming maybe Tuesday morning skate. Bruins are completely off Monday, so we won't hear anything today. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of expecting Forbert to miss a little more time, and I think they want to keep the D rotation going and get, you know, keep guys fresh, get them days off. So, and they do want to get Zboril into some games again, just to see what you have and just to get him more ready than he was, because, you know, he can practice hard and skate and all that and, like, be part of the team, be around the guys, but actually playing NHL games is completely different. And yeah, I thought, you know, him and Clifton got stuck in their own zone a couple times, but for the most part, yeah, I thought Zboril looked pretty solid. He broke up a couple injuries. You mentioned, you know, the assist on the Hathaway goal. He also started the breakout on DeBrusk's goal with a pass over to Clifton that he actually partially whiffed on, but he had so much space that it still got there and worked all the same. But yeah, he ends up playing 18 minutes. His last 2 games, which first off have been spread over 3 months, so they don't help all that much anyways, but he only played 6 and 7 minutes in those games. So
yeah,
because it was a blowout yesterday, they're able to really get him into a game with a lot of minutes. They were also able, Montgomery was also able to manage other guys' minutes. Bergeron only played like 11 something. Martian was like 13. So, you know, we've highlighted that a few times this year that Montgomery will in game do like some load management and just totally cut back on some minutes for, you know, those top guys and older guys and give it to the fourth line and Zboril and Clifton and, you know, let them kind of run with a heavier workload.
Yeah, Zboril only got like 40 seconds less ice time than McAvoy. So, I mean, they were, and if you look at the time on ice for the defensemen, they're all pretty similar. So it's not, everybody was out there for quite a bit. And Zboril did get some penalty killing time. Obviously, he'd be expected to do that, especially when you're coming in for Forbert, that you're going to need to be able to kill penalties as well.
The biggest thing for Zboril, in my opinion, if he were to draw into the lineup in the playoffs for one reason or another, is just he just has to – he can't – the moment can't be too big for him. He can't rush plays. He can't – like, don't try to move the puck before you're supposed to because you're trying to avoid a forecheck hit. Or, you know, don't try to be too pretty and go up the middle. Just keep it simple and play a smart game. And if he can do that, then Zboril has, you know, he has a skill set to be a, you know, a bottom pair NHL guy. I just feel like he lacks a bit of, maybe composure or physicality. And I don't mean physicality in the sense where like, he's not afraid to like hit somebody, but like physicality also means being able to take a hit. Right. And I just feel like that's part of the game that he needs to improve on. Especially if they were to rely on him coming into a playoff series at some point. So that should be the focus for him, is just keep things simple and smart, and he can be a reliable option if he has to enter the picture at some point. Did you have any closing thoughts on that?
No, I did want to circle back to the second line, the combination and how you guys thought that looked, and just in general, obviously Bertuzzi was there with Pastrnak and Zacha. Which I think that's the first time that combination has ever been together, because obviously Krejci's usually part of that equation on the check line. So how did you think they played together? What do you like about what a line like that could look like with Bertuzzi on it? Obviously, they're not going to break up the check line if they don't have to for some reason, but just in the amount of time that you guys get to see it, what'd you think? And do you think Bertuzzi is finding his game a little bit more in Boston? You still think there's probably another level left? Cause I feel like they still haven't found the perfect spot for him, but he's looked good on every line. He just hasn't been able to get that goal.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best spot so far has clearly been with Coyle and Frederick. And, you know, obviously the only reason they split that up is because Krejci's out, so someone's going to move up. I would expect him to get more time with Coyle and Frederick, and, you know, really the interesting discussion becomes when Taylor Hall returns, what do you do? Because Taylor Hall has started skating. He's been on the ice at Warrior. You know, obviously the team was on the road, so there was no opportunity to like be with to join the team. We'll see if he gets on the ice with the team at any point this week. They're scheduled to have a couple morning skates. I think they're practicing in full on Wednesday and possibly Friday as well. So, you know, we'll see if he's on the ice in like a no contact jersey at some point, or if it's still just skating on his own, which it might be for another week or so. So, because then the discussion becomes, okay, Taylor Hall, if he's healthy, is going in. So is it Bertuzzi moves over to the right wing and you have Hall, Coyle, Bertuzzi, and, you know, Frederick goes down to the fourth line for now? Or, you know, what exactly does that look like? Is one of Hall or Bertuzzi on the fourth line, which isn't really, you know, a natural fit for those guys? I don't think either one is really suited to the kind of heavy defensive zone shifts that Montgomery tends to give his fourth line. So that's, you know, for now, I like Bertuzzi with Coyle and Frederick. I think they were finding some chemistry. Obviously, you know, I'm sure he still wants to score that first goal, and he's, as you mentioned earlier, he's been close. He double doinks one off, you know, both posts. He kicks one in. So, you know, that'll kind of be like a little bit of a monkey off his back once he's able to do that. But otherwise, I think he's playing well. You know, I think, like I said, that some of the setups he has to teammates and in high danger areas, the way he puts pucks into good areas, just his passing in general, you know, I think he's been pretty good on the forecheck. He's not, you know, he's not the most physical player in the world in the sense of like hitting guys. But I think he's definitely finding his game and playing better.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. I think the last thing that needs to happen for him is just confidence, and that's going to come with time with this team. And obviously a couple of goals going in that actually count will help that as well. I think there's more of a pest nature to his game that hasn't really come out yet. And I think some of that also has to do with he's trying to find his way in Boston and not be a detriment by taking dumb penalties. I think that kind of just comes out of his game naturally when he's on top of his game. But as Scott mentioned, I mean, that's, you know, barring injury, that's just not a combination I think we'll see this year with Krejci in there. And as far as like what to do with Frederick, because like, yeah, if Taylor Hall comes back, you know, it becomes a much more compelling situation when Nick Foligno's healthy, right? Because when Foligno's healthy, now who are you taking out? If Taylor Hall comes back and Nick Foligno's still out, well, you'll do Hall, Bertuzzi, and Coyle, and then you'll do Nosek with Hathaway on the right and Frederick on the left. And you'll just bounce Greer or Lauko out of the lineup, because I don't see them sending Trent Frederick up to the ninth floor if Nick Foligno's spot is still there to be had on the fourth line. You know what I mean? So I think that when Taylor Hall comes back, they'll keep Frederick in the lineup on that fourth line just to see how that new look third line would appear. And then they'll kick that can down the road as far as who would be the odd man out if and when Foligno's healthy. But if Foligno's still out of the lineup, then Greer or Lauko would be the odd man out, in my opinion. I do think they put Frederick on the fourth line. I think they like that look on the third line of like having that big body nature of Hall and of Frederick and Coyle. But don't forget, like, Taylor Hall's a puck possession guy too. He's a big boy out there, and Bertuzzi plays bigger than he is. So I think that's probably what you would do. I don't know what the timeline is on Taylor Hall. I don't think anybody does. I don't know if you guys have any guesses. Obviously, if he's healthy, they like to try to get him into the lineup before playoff starts, which don't look now, but is like less than a month away, right? Or about a month away.
Yeah, it's like April 14th is their last regular season game, I think, or right in that range. So, yeah, I would say about a month then, because usually get some time off and then hit the first round. Yeah, the 13th. The 13th is their last regular season game at Montreal. So,
okay.
Yeah, and there won't be much time off because they're going to start that weekend right after the April 15th, 16th.
Okay, and that's a Thursday. So, I think.
So, yeah, I mean, Bridget, I thought that line looked good. I just didn't put much stock into it yesterday because I just knew it wasn't really a long-term thing to be looking for, I guess, if that makes any sense. But I'm really curious to see how Bertuzzi, Hall, and Coyle would fare. I mean, like, Bertuzzi, Coyle, and Frederick is great. It's a great third line. It's up there probably with the best in the league. But if Taylor Hall and Tyler Bertuzzi are on your third line wings – and they're on their game, I mean, that's really stupid. And I mean that in a complimentary way. Like, that is insane, insane depth and embarrassment of riches. And I think that, you know, as great as Frederick's been, he's not a former MVP in the league. He's not a former first overall pick. Like, he's going to have to slide down to that fourth line. And then from there, you know, he's going to have to battle it out with Hathaway and Foligno and Greer. And guess what? At this point, we're not talking Wayne Gretzky. Like, we're talking all guys that, you know, I don't think your cup hopes are riding and dying on if Frederick is on your fourth line or if he's sitting. He's a great little player. He's having a great year, but yeah. One thing I did want to bring up to you guys too, and Scott, you kind of brought up the power play and Lindholm getting things back in order at the top of the umbrella. Pasternak's two goals this weekend got him to 48 on the year, with about 13 games or so left. Now, obviously, Pasternak is a 50-goal-plus caliber player. He would have already eclipsed this this milestone a couple of years ago had it not been for COVID interrupting him. I think he actually had 48 goals or 47 goals, yeah. Something like that.
It was 48.
It was actually a pretty similar pace with, like, 12 games to go, right? Or 10 games to go? Or...
Yeah, I think
pretty similar. Yeah,
what did they finish at? 70 or 72 that year? So
yeah, I think it was 70. So I mean, he would have gotten 50 that year. But I guess my question is, do you think that when he officially hits 50 this year, unless he has the quietest goal slump of his career, like, or outside of maybe his rookie year, do you think that him being the first Bruin to hit 50 since Cam Neely officially means a lot to the organization and to Pastrnak?
Good question. I don't know. So one thing I did just think of is when COVID hit and it was clear like they weren't going to be able to finish the season. I remember at the time if he was asked, like, you know, are you disappointed? Like, you won't be able to get to 50. And he said he was more disappointed that he couldn't get to 100 points. Cause I think he was at like 96 or something that year. And he said, because, you know, cause he takes a lot of pride in his playmaking too. And so the total package of the points meant more. So, you know, I'm sure if like 50 goals is a great accomplishment. And as you just said, like, been a long time since a Bruin has done it. So I think, you know, he will appreciate it, but like, I don't think he'll really let on a ton. You know, I think it'll be a lot of, yeah, we have, you know, bigger goals, I have bigger goals, all that. But yeah, to be the best Bruins goal scorer in almost 30 years, like, you got to take some personal pride in that. And he already was, you know, he doesn't need the 5-0 to, you know, to make that case or for that to be true. But it does highlight, like, okay, he really is doing something that this franchise hasn't seen in a while. And that is just a remarkable accomplishment in and of itself. Like, we're in an era of higher scoring now. Goal scoring has been going up for the last, you know, almost better part of a decade, 7-8 years. And yet you're still only going to finish the season with a few guys who top 50. So it's still just a really impressive individual accomplishment. And, you know, and I do think he's also improved as a goal scorer. Like, you see that with the goal yesterday, Sunday, where that kind of step inside where, okay, a team is taking away his one-timer from the left dot. We've seen that a lot more this year, where he takes that extra step or two inside and wrists it or snaps it on goal and is able to beat goalies that way. So, you know, I think he's kind of diversified his goal scoring and his offense as well, and that's a big reason that he's now tied for his career high and is going to break it, you know, barring something crazy.
Yeah, and it was 95 points that he had that COVID year. Yeah. And he has 93 now. So he's approaching that pretty quickly as well. And yeah, I mean, that's obviously just a huge accomplishment. It's the season he's been having. It's not surprising that, you know, he's going to get there. And I don't know, just in general, he's had such a good year. I wouldn't be surprised if we see him get there like next game. Like, he could just have 2 goals and he's there. So it could happen very, very soon. And I don't think anyone would be completely surprised. So yeah, I mean, just good for him to get to 50, for the first time in his career, but it's not going to be the last time, I doubt.
No, definitely not. And, you know, you guys mentioned the pride he takes in reaching that 100-point marker. I mean, you see guys hit 100 points a lot where it's like, you know, whatever, 25 goals and 75 assists or whatever. I mean, Pastrnak, the balance is pretty remarkable, right? 48 goals, 45 assists as he stands today. So just to the pride he takes in being a playmaker, like Scott talked about, it shows in the stat sheets as well. So just a very, very well-rounded offensive player for sure. And we've talked about it in the past, just the different ways he can score goals, what makes him elite, what makes him special. And if he, you know, now that we know he's here for another 8 years, you know, the title for the greatest goal scorer in the franchise's history, 100 plus year history, or actually 100 year next year history. That's pretty damn cool. That's very, very special. So he's on track to do that by career's end. And so really cool to get to watch him in his prime right now. Yeah. Was he 26 right now, right?
Yeah. And I think I did the math when he signed the extension, or I think I actually did it like a little before that, but on an eight year deal, it's like, basically if he averages like 36 goals a year, he'll break Johnny Busick's franchise record by the end of this contract.
Which speaks highly of Chief too, of Busick. Like, that's, that's pretty crazy that, you know, what he was able to accomplish too back in the day as well. So I don't know how many years he played in Boston. Certainly not, it won't, when it's all not as many as Pastrnak will be at that point, right? At the end of his next contract, it will be what, 15 years he's played in Boston? Pastrnak, well, how many years?
Dubusek's more.
Oh, was he?
22, 23. Like, he was in the 20s. So a lot of longevity there.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. Okay. Either way, I would take either one of them on my team. across all eras. Bridget, was there any other takeaways from the weekend that you wanted to go over?
I did want to talk about Frederick just for a second. The fight that he had, and that the fact that he got, like, he was getting battered this weekend. He took a stick to the jaw, and that was bothering him for a little bit. He got into a few mix-ups and one fight with Cousins that Cousins got the early jump on him, and he took a bunch of punches right off the bat, but then he kind of turned it around and started winning that fight, but then they broke it up and he was really pissed because as soon as he started getting punches in, they stepped in between him. But just how have you thought his physicality has been? I feel like he's playing his best hockey in both ways, that he's being kind of a pest and doing what he does, which we already knew he could do, which is the fighting and the, you know, the toughness. And then he's also added the scoring. I feel like we're watching him play the best hockey that he's played in his career. And he had goals in three straight games, which is the first time he's done that in his career as well.
Yeah, he absolutely is playing the best hockey of his career. And just to clarify and Busek, because I just looked it up, 21 years, 57 to 78. So, yeah, so on Frederick, I feel like pretty much all season, like, this is what he's been doing is, you know, he's really broken out as a goal scorer. I think more than half of his career goals have been scored this season. And yeah, he is still bringing physicality. He's not being foolish about it. Like, he's not just running around trying to drill guys. He's not taking bad penalties or anything like that. So that's also, you know, part of what he'll have to bring if he does end up on the fourth line, obviously, because I think especially the wings on that line, you know, Nosek is the center, obviously, is, you know, he can play physical as well and use his size, but he's really there more as like support, kind of the safeguard, you know, he just kind of manages everything from the middle. But then like the wings, they want that attitude of like, you know, be an asshole to play against, basically. Like, that's,
oh, Poso when, did try to fight Nosek in that Buffalo,
yeah, game. True.
I don't think Nosek wanted much of it. But
no, I think we've seen that fighting is not Tomas Nosek's strength. But yeah, so, you know, whether it's Hathaway and Lauko, Greer, Felina, Fred, like whoever you want to put on that fourth line, the wings there are going to have, like, they're going to be kind of the attitude of the team. You know, if you want to throw Clifton in on the back end as someone who brings some of that too, but it's, you know, for years it's been like, you know, how often did Bruce Cassidy talk about Brad Marchand pulling guys into the fight with him? And, you know, he was the one who, in a top line role, who would sort of bring that. And now I think you're seeing that they have a bunch of these guys in the bottom six who can do that and are willing to do that. And Frederick is certainly one of them, and, you know, has done it quite a bit this year and is also producing offensively.
I mean, who had Trent Frederick as a 20 goal guy going into the season? It's not out of the question for him. He's at 16 right now, and a Baker's dozen games to go. It really is not out of the question at all. So for him to be a 20 goal, 35, 37 point guy potentially this year is really remarkable. And good sign for the Bruins, for the Bruins for the future, that he's not a bust of a draft pick. And I think there's stats to back up just how he stacks up against the rest of his draft class. He's actually doing pretty good compared to the rest of his class. So yeah, it's impressive. And I mean, yeah, he's tied for six on the Bruins in goals scored. And, you know, obviously, you know who the top four or five are going to be. It's Bergeron, Marchand, Pastrnak, DeBrusque, Zaka's in there. And I think it's Hall and Frederick, or I think Lindholm might be, no, Lindholm's not there. So Hall and Frederick are tied for six. So, yeah, good on him. And yet here we are talking about a potential situation where he has to, you know, slide down in the lineup, because that's just how much depth this team has this year. So it's just it's pretty remarkable. Yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit for this Bruins team this year. I mean, as we get closer and closer to the playoffs here, it's kind of like, I don't know, it really is cup or bust this year for this team. And I know that that phrase is tossed around every year for one or two teams probably, but this Bruins team is more cup or bust than previous NHL teams were cup or bust. Like, this is it's win or fail for this team, which sucks for them, because it's impossible. It's like, okay, you follow through and you do that, and people are like, well, good, that's what you should have done, you know. And anything short of that, it's like you're the biggest choke artist in the world. So it's a really tough situation for them to be in, but it's the bed that they've made for themselves, because they've been that good. It's the standard that they've set, right?
Yeah, and you know, we've brought up before, but like, it's also just a once in a generation situation where you have your top two centers signed for $4 million and they're still as good as they are. Like, that's it. That is a big part of what has allowed you to be easily the deepest team in the NHL and one of the deepest teams we've seen in a long time. You know, you give Sweeney credit for making the right moves to add to that depth, you know, getting Zacha and Orlov and Bertuzzi and Hathaway, what he's brought. Like, yes, you've also had to hit on getting the right depth pieces with that extra money you have and with the trades you make, but you're in a situation to be able to do that because of what Bergeron and Krejci have done for your team. And every other team would absolutely kill to be in that kind of situation where you have two players of that caliber signed for that little money and look at it and go, wow, look at what this allows us to do on our third line, fourth line, on, you know, our top four defensemen and all that. Like, it's, and you're not going to have that going forward. Like, you're going to run into cap issues next year. You have too many free agents. You don't know what Bergeron and Krejci's status is. Doesn't mean, you know, you're totally falling out of it. Like, you can still, there's absolutely multiple paths where they still have a very competitive team next year, but it unquestionably will not be as deep as this one. So yes, like, you want to really take advantage of this and make the most of it, because you are the best team, the cup, you know, you are easily the favorite to win the cup. We know there are things that can happen that are out of their control. If David Pastrnak and Charlie McAvoy go down in the first two games of round one, I mean, you throw your hands up and go, whatever. Like, there was just nothing we could do about that. But if you stay relatively healthy, like, yes, they should beat anyone in a 7-game series. So, yeah, it puts a lot of pressure to say cup or bust, but that's what it is. And they've embraced that, I think. Like, they've talked about how it's a special season. They know what their goals are. They don't care about these regular season records. So, you know, that they know what it is. Like, they're not, I don't think they're feeling that pressure or, you know, are going to crumble under it or anything like that. I think they know what it is, and they've embraced being that team, being the one that has the target on their back all year.
I'm going to try to talk, but Melvin has been sassy. He's been, that's why I haven't talked in like 5 minutes, because he decided to start barking. But one Stop thing that I, all the time. Yeah, if you were watching on YouTube, you saw me going, no, let's stop it with my mic off. But now he's trying to drink my water. So one conversation that was had on the broadcast that I thought Scott wanted to chime in on was the Lindholm Norris conversation that Jack keeps bringing up, and, you know, also taking shots at Erik Karlsson for some reason. I don't know what Erik Karlsson ever did to him, but I mean,
that has been a career long thing with Jack and Erik Karlsson. Like, we could rewind 10 years and he would be saying the same things when Karlsson was winning Norris trophies with Ottawa. Like, it's just baffling to me. Like, he is, so much of Erik Karlsson's career was spent in the division, and like, to get an up close and personal look at how talented of a player he is and how, you know, he produces at offensive levels not seen by a defenseman since Ray Bourque and Paul Coffey. And arguably, given like the era and how, you know, early in his career he was playing in a lower scoring era, like arguably even more impressive than some of the seasons those guys had. And to not have like an appreciation for that, and to just constantly, again, for over 10 years now, just like shit on Erik Karlsson's defense and, oh, he doesn't play in the penalty kill. Like, Jack's using that to argue that, you know, he can't win the Norris because he doesn't play on San Jose's penalty kill. And what really got me is like, he's talking about, you know, if Erik Karlsson's so valuable and the Sharks are, you know, struggling as a team, why doesn't he kill penalties to help them win? And it's like, San Jose's penalty kill is one of the only good things that team has. So like, why would you waste Erik Karlsson on it when you can instead play him more at 5-on-5? He has played more 5-on-5 minutes than anyone in the NHL this season. And the Sharks are, when he is on the ice at 5-on-5, the Sharks are a very good team. When he is not on the ice, they are one of the worst in the NHL. So, like,
that's... Yeah, and I feel like his argument was also like, well, if he's so good, why is he on a team that sucks? Like, if he's so good, why aren't they, you know, yeah, in first place in the division? Like,
it's like, I don't know. Look at the rest of that roster.
I know. It's like, you could put Connor McDavid on a team full of scrubs, and yeah, they're not going to finish first, even though they have Connor McDavid. But
that, you just more the Oilers of the last 7 years.
Yeah,
exactly. So I guess the main Bruins point, though, is Lindholm, and the conversation about, is he, sorry, Melvin's doing it again. I'll let you guys pick up.
He's got some really strong takes on the Norris race.
He really is trying to make a case for Lindholm right now.
What do you think, Karlsson sucks?
Yeah, that's what he's chirping over here. But what do you guys think of Lindholm? Is that kind of, you know, a silly conversation? Obviously, he's a good defenseman, but what, you know, Erik Karlsson versus Lindholm, where do you see that?
Here's the thing. It's not a silly conversation. And if Jack wants to make the case for Hampus Lindholm winning the Norris, I think you can actually do it. I just don't think you have to totally shit on Erik Karlsson in order to do it. Like, you can still recognize that Erik Karlsson is having a really special season. He's probably going to top 100 points, which is crazy for a defenseman. You know, the case for Lindholm is like, you can look at his defensive impact, because him and Carlo have been one of the arguably the best shutdown defensive pairing in the NHL this season. Bruins do not get scored on when they're on the ice. That's where you make the argument. Like, the Athletic did, you know, the Athletic and ESPN do like regular awards watches like every month. And I think the Athletic's last one came out last week. And from a Bruins perspective, everyone jumped on, because the way they list it is they just use a stat called like goal save value added or something, basically like goals above replacement. And Bruins fans jumped on Ilya Sorokin grading out ahead of Linus Ullmark, even though the write-up itself said Ullmark's going to win the Vezina. But I feel like what a bunch of Bruins fans didn't discuss is that it had Hampus Lindholm tied for the lead in the Norris race, in basically what was like a five-way tie with Karlsson, Rasmus Dahlin, Brent Burns, and there was some, oh, Adam Fox, were like the five who were all separated by like 1 point in this goal saved stat. So like, there is a case to be made because Lindholm has been so good defensively and has also contributed 40 points, which, you know, isn't the 90 that Karlsson has, but is still pretty damn impressive. You know, but that just like, that wasn't the case that Jack was making. He was just trying to tear down Erik Karlsson. And I, you know, Hampus Lindholm is not going to win the Norris. It will be Karlsson. And if other guys are getting votes, it's going to be Adam Fox, who has the points and the defensive play. It'll probably be Rasmus Dahlin, who has really had a spectacular, you know, I want to say breakout, not really breakout, but has really taken the next step into stardom. But I think Hampus Lindholm will probably finish top five, and I think there's absolutely a case that he deserves more love than that.
I mean, I feel like I don't even know if, as good as he's been, I don't know if Lindholm would even win the award for best defenseman on the Bruins this year, because I feel like McAvoy's defensive metrics are probably just as impressive, if not more, and maybe Scott, you can correct me on that. But
well, he has more points, McAvoy. Well,
Lindholm has one more point than McAvoy, but he's also played like 10 more games than McAvoy. So yeah.
That's what I mean. Game, points per game. Yeah, McAvoy's higher.
McAvoy's edges Lindholm significantly, really. And then I feel like the defensive metrics and advanced stats, McAvoy has to at least be on par with Lindholm, and you know, relatively. So I feel like, yeah, there's no doubt about it. He's had a special year, and he's a special player, and he's totally, end of year awards aside, the addition of Lindholm to this Bruins team has just been, I mean, words really can't describe how important it's been. He's turned, it's just, there's so much deeper with him. There's so much more dynamic with him. There's so much less pressure on McAvoy and less attention on Matt. It's what an addition, like seriously. So, whether or not he wins the Norris or should win the Norris, I really don't care, because I think he's going to help the Bruins win a Stanley Cup, and that's all I really care about. There was something else I wanted to go with this. But, oh, yes. So I was just looking at the Bruins' next game, and they're playing the Senators, who have quickly fallen out of the playoff chase because they were once right in the mix, and now they've kind of fallen down. And right now it's kind of a three-way race for the wild card spot between Pittsburgh, the Islanders, and the Panthers. And I don't know about you guys. I really don't want to see Matthew Tkachuk for 7 games in the first round. And I just feel like the Panthers could be like a very spooky team to play in the first round, because I feel like they've had not a great year for their standards, but I feel like they're more formidable than the Islanders or the Penguins. I know the Penguins have Crosby and Malkin and stuff like that. I get that, but I don't think they have much more than that. Does the Panthers sneaking up on Pittsburgh scare either one of you guys?
I mean, I do think that their matchup-wise might cause more of an issue for the Bruins, but I don't see either of them as like a insurmountable like opponent that they couldn't get past. I think either way, Brian, what are you? Am I the only one who's got internet working right now? Yeah, I don't think it's a huge deal, but it is scary in the way that they're turning it on at the right time. So if they're able to make themselves bring themselves back into the race, I guess they're not a team you can really count out if they're playing well at this time of year.
Yeah, Florida doesn't scare me.
Not the way they used to. They used to be a team you'd go, oh, we do not want to match up against them in the playoffs, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's been a long time since that's probably been the case. Even last year, like they just weren't nearly good enough defensively, and Lightning totally exposed them. I think they're even worse defensively this year. So that, yeah, you don't want to face Matthew Tkachuk, and he would have the potential of landing a hard hit that hurts someone. I get that, but most teams are going to have someone like that, at least from the physicality department. And yeah, Florida could put up some goals, but I just think they're not good enough defensively. And Bruins, I think, would still make a pretty short series of that. The one to me that still worries me the most is the Islanders, just because looking at like the different wildcard teams, Ilya Sorokin is the one goalie who could steal a couple games. And potentially, if he gets red hot, and maybe, you know, God forbid the Bruins goaltending struggles a little bit, like could potentially steal a series. And that above anything else, worry, like take out injuries because they're very hard to predict. But in terms of like on ice or players or teams or whatever, Ilya Sorokin scares me more than anyone else in that wildcard picture. So I would gladly take a matchup with Florida or Pittsburgh over the Islanders.
Yeah, I'm not really concerned about losing a series to the Panthers, or it was more so just like the attrition part of it. Like, could you see Matthew Tkachuk just doing one of his stupid reverse hits or hip checks and, you know, effing up somebody's knee or whatever, and whatever. Pittsburgh doesn't scare me in the least. And I'm not trying to be disrespectful to some of their players, but I just don't think they have what it takes as a team. Islanders, I mean, they have the goalie, but he'd have to get probably 7 shutouts to beat the Bruins in a series. So, cause they just can't really score that well. But anyway, I was just curious because Florida's been, we haven't talked about them this year much. Cause after last year, they've really just struggled to start this year. But here they come now as April approaches, and they have as good a chance as anybody in that wild card to crack the playoffs and whatnot. So I found that interesting because Buffalo and Ottawa were like right there, and now they've just dropped, and Florida's still there. So it's starting to the East playoff picture is starting to clear up a little bit, yeah, and see kind of who's who.
Yeah, Washington, yeah, Detroit, as well.
Yeah, Detroit was right there for a while too, and then they sold, and that, you know, really seemed to just kill any momentum they had.
Yeah, and the Capitals were sellers too. So, yeah, those teams that were right on the bubble. Yeah, it is weird. Like, the Capitals still could make the playoffs. Like, they still could make that last wild card spot, but they're
Craig Smith revenge series.
Yeah, they yeah, they took a different approach at the trade deadline that, you know, they weren't going to really make a push, I guess. But all three of those teams that you mentioned, the Islanders, the Penguins, and the Panthers, are all within like 2 points of each other, 2 or 3 points of each other. So, yeah, they're all within 3 points. So any of those teams could end up being your matchup. If you're the Bruins, you would rather see the Islanders finish in that first wild card spot where they are right now and avoid them in that first round series, like Scott said, and then you'd take Pittsburgh or the Panthers.
Well, the good news is we have time to discuss those in further detail down the line. I just kind of a little food for thought. I just noticed that in the standings. I thought I'd ask that. But Bridget, Scott, is there anything else you wanted to go over before we sign off?
No. One last note on Swayman.
He says no, and then he starts saying something.
True, yeah.
Okay. He's like, no, but Merrimack lost to BU, Brian, so suck it.
I was gonna close with that as well. As you can tell, I got the BU hat, BU sweatshirt.
Hey, I'm a Terrier too. I told you about that one certificate class I took in 2016.
Yeah, for Brian ate in the student union once.
My brother went there, so it counts, right?
And so on Swayman, back-to-back shutouts is the first time a goalie's done that for the Bruins in season since Tuukka Rask in April 2013, so 10 years ago. So, you know, pretty impressive couple games for him. And even Sunday, like, where it obviously turns into a blowout, you know, I did think late in the first period, early in the second, he had a couple really nice saves. One was Casey Mittelstadt point blank on the doorstep. And it's like, at that point, it's 3-0. You know, you think the Bruins are running away with it, but maybe if the Sabres get one, they get some sort of momentum going into the first intermission. But that, you know, like that really felt like almost the end of the game. Like, Sabres finally got a good chance, couldn't score, and it was over from there.
Yeah, I mean, so I did want to talk. We always seem to gloss over the goaltending part.
Because just like, yeah, they've been awesome. Okay, next.
The one thing I said about him was he ate a chicken wing. So like, that was the commentary. But no, yeah, I guess it's like we don't have anything to criticize, so we kind of just go by it. But no, Swayman played really well. Big shutout for him, 2 in a row. So, it's just the same old, where it's like, okay, well, there's not a goalie slump. Neither of them are slumping. Neither of them really have had an extended or even like a 2-game, 3-game slump. So there's nothing to be concerned about for the Bruins in terms of goaltending right now. And that's really the only takeaway.
I mean, look, as far as the Bruins go, whether it's in goal or elsewhere, I just feel like as long as this team plays on their toes, I really can't see a scenario where somebody bests them 4 out of 7 times in a series. If they play assertive, if they play on their toes, if they take the game to their opponent and don't whatever, like, this Bruins team is too deep. They're too talented. And that extends to between the pipes too. But if they enter the playoffs and they're just kind of going through the motions like they were a few weeks over the last couple of weeks at times, well, then you're human just like everybody else. So this, and I'm not concerned that this team's going to get to the playoffs and go through the motions. So, yeah, I mean, the goaltending has been awesome. There's only so much you can really highlight how great a save was. I mean, it's just, they've just been, I mean, hell, we've even talked, it's been so good. We're talking about them scoring goals. They're joining the rush too. I know people talk about Montgomery's system. The D are joining the rush. So are the goalies. So it's just, it's all, yeah, it's, everybody's playing fantastic this year. And, we hope that they build on that going into the playoffs. And I can speak for all of us, really looking forward to the playoffs this year. I mean, well, this team on paper is just so fun.
The one thing I was concerned about was the goalie hug at the end of the game where they both almost, I thought they were going to hurt themselves because it was more than just a regular hug because it was a shutout. They jumped into it and they both landed. And I was like, if they just both knock themselves over right now, how dumb would it be to have the two best goalies in the league get hurt hugging in this time? Like in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, wouldn't that just be like,
you know what they need to do?
The worst possible thing.
You know what they need to do? They need to do after a game, after the next win or a playoff win or something like that, or like a playoff series win, they got to just do that. They just got to put all their cards on the table and go all in and do the dirty dancing and have the garden play time of your life and just have one of them lift up the other by the waist and just glide around the ice. It's and at that point now.
And then you go, how did Jeremy Swayman get hurt? Oh, Ullmark lifted him over his head in the dirty dancing move and he both fell down and broke his arm.
He did the Swayze.
Well, that was like Hockey East this weekend. I forget if it was Friday or Saturday, but BU's goalie collided with the linesman as he was going to the bench during a delayed penalty. And
that was Saturday.
Yeah.
And in the championship game.
Yeah, like Razor during the Nesson intermission. Like they were laughing about because everyone's okay, fortunately. But he's like, imagine you lose your starting goalie because he ran into the linesman trying to get to the bench.
Yeah, that was weird. The whole Hockey East championship weekend was just weird. As a whole.
Lots of overtime.
Too much overtime, Scott. I got home at 1 a.m. Friday after three separate overtimes spread out through both of the games. By the end of Saturday, I was thinking to myself, I always say overtime hockey is great. It's bonus hockey. But at some point, there reaches a point where it's too much hockey. And I think we were almost there.
Especially because like those games, really all three to an extent were defensive struggles, which, I guess, hey, defense wins championships, but
especially the two overtime game between UMass Lowell and Merrimack. That was just like, I'm glad I wasn't broadcasting it because I don't know what I would have said. And Tyler Murray, who was broadcasting it for WEI, lost his voice after Friday's games and like struggled through Saturday because it was too much talking. I wouldn't want to hear myself talk that long. But they got through it. I talked to Tom Karen Saturday as well. I talked to him right before the overtime in Saturday's game, and he was like, I don't know if I can do this, like I'm losing my voice, it's going. So luckily that was a short overtime, and Scott got the happy outcome. Brian, I'm sorry. Merrimack is also going to the tournament.
So. Yeah. There's still time to get revenge. Speaking of losing your voice, Scott, how was the Southie Parade, St. Patrick's Day Parade? Were you on one of the floats screaming?
That's right. Yeah. The skate pod float.
Free WEEI.
Yeah. How did your tiger tattoo come out?
It looks good, guys. It looks really good.
All right. Well,
he'll show us after we sign off.
Yeah.
I think we're probably good.
That's for the Patreon.
Are you saying it's paid content? You are going to have to pay to see Scott's tattoo. Yeah. All right. Well, at least he knows how to monetize what the people want to see.
Yeah. Scott's making like seven figures off his OnlyFans account. So. All right.
What's your username, Scott? No, I'm just kidding. All right, we've gone off the rails again officially.
All right. Well, Bridget, get your finger on that button.
wait.
All right. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you guys soon.